This is the Geek Improvement Podcast. Tune in. Geek out.
Welcome to the Geek Improvement Podcast, the official podcast of geekimprovement.com, where we help you find and keep track of the things you geek out about. I'm your host, Alexis Santos, and just like last week, we've got David and Terry. How you doing, guys?
Not too bad, Alexis. Glad to be back. And this time, it's without months and months and months of intervals like the last time you had me on. I'm shocked.
Which was about a year and 3 months. Mm-hmm. David, you doing okay?
Oh, yeah, I'm doing just fine, Alexis, just fine.
And we also have a guest. If you're not counting Terry, which now that he's going to be on regular interviews, technically our very first guest, David J. Sushil. He is an independent game developer. How you doing, David?
I am being held against my will in this podcast, but I'm happy to be here.
We told you not to say that.
Well,
so
you know,
sorry.
We'll fix
or
it in post.
Or else it gets the hose again.
We'll fix it in post. We'll take out all your cries for help, and no one will ever know.
The magic of editing.
Exactly. So, you know, let's just jump right into it. We've got you here held hostage because we want to talk about your next video game that you're working on called Neo-Victorian Skirmish Squad. It's up on Kickstarter. So, David, why don't you tell us, or we should probably refer to you, Sushil, now, if you don't mind, so we can keep our David straight. Tell us a little bit about Neo-Victorian Skirmish Squad.
Sure. So my team and I have been working on this game for about a year now. It's a turn-based role-playing game that has a kind of innovative dice mechanic that we're playing around with. So for people that are familiar with games in the vein of Yahtzee, which are known as yacht-like games, we're kind of throwing in this dice mechanic where every action that you do in the role-playing game is influenced by how well you score in that yacht game. So this allows for some really innovative ways to handle dice. And in fact, you can level up, train, and fuse all of your dice in the game to create new variations, which have sometimes subtle and wild effects in battle and combat. So it's a very art-driven game. It's very story-rich. We've got a lot of casual gameplay for people that aren't really into RPGs, but then there's also some very deep mechanics for people that enjoy things like leveling up stats and combining and crafting different items.
And, you know, I was surprised to see the dice play such a prominent role in the game because usually the dice are a vehicle. They're a substitute for, hey, my weapon does this. But this time, they actually have a direct effect.
Right. They're actually the only items that your characters have in the game. So each character that you play with has a pocket full of these dice and their own scorecard. And we wanted to kind of subvert the idea of dice in role-playing games. So, rather than, like you said, just having dice compute stats and serving as a placeholder for weapons and items, it is the only weapon or item that you have. And I think it's very satisfying. It kind of removes some of the challenge from RPGs that casual gamers might experience, but the way that we're handling it with all the combinations and fusions, there really is a lot for more advanced role-playing gamers to find satisfying in this experience as well.
So what kind of effects can some of the dice have?
Sure. So there are actually 13 different dice in the game. And you start off with just normal dice. And once you roll them so much in combat, they gain experience and level up. And when that happens, then you can combine normal dice to create a kind of second tier of dice, which are attack dice. We have defense dice and healing dice, and then those can be combined as well to create a third tier, which is three more sets of dice, and so on and so forth until you've kind of filled out all 13. So it's kind of a process getting to some of the more advanced dice in the game, but they're definitely worth it because they have the most effects. And pretty much by the end, you don't even care what you're getting on your scorecard. You're just rolling dice and watching the effects happen. Nice. It's like a giant fireworks display of effects by the end of the game.
So I take it there are a vast amount of these effects?
Oh, yeah, definitely. So aside from the normal dice, 12 of the dice in the game have these different effects. And depending on who's holding the dice and what combinations you have, those effects can kind of vary wildly.
So before we get too deep into the game mechanics themselves, let's talk a bit about story. So it's a Neo-Victorian skirmish squad. So what are we trying to do in the game?
Okay, so at the start of the game, we're introduced to Professor Bellwether, who is a professor at John Brummel University. It's the nation's foremost institute for Neo-Victorian studies. Here, they try to solve the world's problems using methods, techniques from kind of the late 1800s, we might say. So it's kind of a wrong-headed way of solving the world's problems, and they know that, but they kind of stick to a very strict moral code. So Dr. Bellwether has just been introduced to his latest research assistant, a young woman by the name of Gisette Leroux, who he does not get along with. Bellwether just wants to be out in the field studying plants and animals. He's kind of a cryptobotanist, what we're calling him in the game. and Gisette is just too optimistic and bubbly for him. And of course, then the university is overrun with monsters, and the pair have to band together, learn how to use these battle dice, and save the university from the monster invasion.
Now, where did the monsters come from?
That's a great question. So as it turns out, John Brummel University exists in any universe that could possibly exist. So it's kind of like a fixed focal point. And the founder of the university, John Brummel, had a vision of this university, and he ended up writing down all of his thoughts and all of these images that were popping into his head into a set of blueprints, and had the university built. And the problem with this is that since it's a location that exists everywhere, sometimes it overlaps with other realities. And in this case, there's a device on campus called an orrery, which is kind of like a model of the solar system, and it usually operates just fine, but it broke. And when it broke, it aligned its planets in the same configuration as another version of John Brummel University in another universe. And so those two universes have kind of overlapped, and our heroes are trying to fix the orrery and get things back to normal.
That is interesting.
It is. It's kind of it's very fresh to see something like different dimensions and the combination of worlds in games. You just don't see it very often, or not done well enough.
And please, at the very end, don't make all our efforts pointless like BioShock Infinite, please.
I was just going to say that.
I can't spoil the ending just yet, but I think everybody will be pretty satisfied with it. And one of the things that I liked about this idea was that, from our hero's perspective, all the monsters that are invading, are villains. But from the monster's perspective, that's true of the humans. And so we're kind of like playing around with that idea that maybe our heroes are actually the villains in somebody else's story. So kind of subverting the narrative a little bit too, which is fun.
That is pretty cool. Now, you've got several reward tiers here for the game. And one of them, I noticed, included a card game.
Yes.
Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah. So, over the last year, my team and I, we've kind of fallen in love with this universe. And also with the gameplay as well. I mean, the mechanics are very simple. For anybody that's played a game like Yahtzee, you can pick this up and run with it pretty easily. And we envisioned, what are some ways that we could maybe expand this in the future, or, maybe reimagine this cast and this university for additional games. And my business partner, Joe, one day he just kind of came into the office and he slapped down this big stack of cards, and he's like, I made this over the weekend, and you have to check it out.
Yes.
And he had basically taken, our yacht-like dice mechanic and made a bunch of cards to augment it. So at the start of the game, each player assumes the role of one of the faculty members or the main characters in the video game. And you start with a certain combination of battle dice. It's actually a deck building game. So you assemble a deck of at least 30 cards. And depending on which character you choose, those cards are kind of themed. And then you basically, each person plays a game of yacht and tries to modify and affect the other person's score, sabotage their efforts and improve their own. And it turned out to be really fun. So we've been playing around with that as well, and designing new cards and playtesting it, and we're really satisfied with the result. So we're doing this kind of in-house. Ultimately, what we'd like to do is release this as a standalone product. Mm-hmm. But at least for the purposes of the Kickstarter, we're actually creating handmade wooden dice specifically for this game, and they are absolutely gorgeous. We found a really cool way to do this just using burnishing, like wood burning, and then staining them, and they just look fabulous too. So it's a really cool collector's item, I think, that some of our backers might enjoy.
Yeah, I'm looking at them now, and those are some really beautiful dice.
Yeah, we're really pleased with those.
So how much time have you been pouring into playtesting this kind of thing? Because I imagine tuning a card game would take a lot of refinements.
Yeah, so the good news is that the main mechanic, which is the yacht game, is pretty well established. And from that point, we're just looking at ways, how can we modify, sabotage your opponent and bolster your own game. And so we took kind of like a balanced approach from the start. I created a spreadsheet and looked at all the different effects that we were trying to apply and tried to kind of divvy those out in a very fair manner across the different characters. And then just started playtesting from there. So we've done testing in the studio. We've done testing at home. I think we have three sets of this game floating around at the moment. While the video game definitely takes precedence at the studio, it's something that we pick up and dust off every once in a while. I think people will be pretty happy with it. It's a very, very breezy game.
So you mentioned the studio, Turncraft Games, right?
Yes, that's correct.
So how many folks are working on the Neo-Victorian Skirmish Squad?
Oh, gosh. we've had quite a few. This is actually the largest team that I've ever managed.
Wow.
I've been making games for 10 years now, and I've worked on games at other studios. But this is the largest one that I've ever tackled myself. And so I've been doing the bulk of the design and the programming. We also have a really solid art team. We have our lead artist, Samantha, and then Raina and Katie, who are doing coloring and texturing for the game. And then Pascal, who does our animations for the characters. Then we have another designer, Joe Rolls, my business partner, Joe, who's handling the production. We have a 3D artist that's helping us out producing some of the rewards for our Kickstarter campaign. That's Zach. And we have another programmer, Daryl, who has kind of helped out with some of the back end, the technical programming for this. So it's a pretty big team.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah. So I've got to ask, life as an indie dev, this is about maybe 6-7 people that are spread out throughout the U.S. or do you have a couple local folks?
Actually, yeah, these people are all local, and that's kind of unusual for me because I have worked on a lot of distributed teams in my previous games. So it's kind of nice to be able to sit down with everybody, we have floor meetings. So we all sit on the floor and kind of do show and tell every Friday. And it's nice, you can get a lot more done, I think, face to face than you can distributed sometimes, especially working on a very collaborative game like this.
I was just about to say, everybody cross your legs Indian style. And
yep. that's pretty much what we do.
Like kindergarten again, yeah. So when we back the game, when can we expect to, put it on our machines and start playing it?
Yeah, so one of our tiers is the $20 tier, you get beta access to the game. And we've been sharing copies of this game in its current form with different reviewers and, let's play people online. Mm-hmm. And we're pretty confident that by say mid-October, we can start distributing betas to our Kickstarter backers. Because right now, you can play the game for about 2 hours before you explore all the content, which is about a quarter of everything that we're going to be putting in. So I think we can expand that, add in more content, and get that out probably by mid-October. And then the final version of the game, we're looking to have it wrapped up by the end of the year with an expected release in the first quarter of 2014.
Okay. And so you guys are working very quickly.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Well, we've got a year behind us at this point. So we've made a lot of progress in that 12-month period. And so now it's just kind of like, all right, let's get the final artwork in there. Let's polish off some of the mechanics and finish the storyline, build out all the different events and beats that happen in the game. So it's coming along really well. And I think in just a few short months, we'll have it wrapped up.
So since you've been working on this for about a year, what's been the inspiration, to get started on it?
So that's kind of interesting. Back in, I think, 2008, I entered a contest. It was a Microsoft-sponsored contest that was promoting one of their internet technologies called Silverlight. Mm. And I created a game called John Brummel University's Blunderbuss Olympics Volume 1. And it's kind of a weird title, but it ended up winning third place in this contest. And it wasn't a great game. I put it together in about 6 weeks, but But it was good enough for third place, which I was happy about. And since then, like, I realized that I had a lot of fun kind of exploring that world that I built in the game. And it was all just like, you know, behind the scenes stuff. Like, there weren't really any characters, just environments and backstory. And I always wanted to go back to that and find out, you know, who are the people that live and work at this university, and what do they really do there? You know, what are their lives like, and what are their challenges? And so I'd always kind of had these characters in the back of my head for the last, say, 5 years. And the dice mechanic is something that I'd also been kicking around kind of as a separate project. And, you know, just one day I kind of woke up and I'm like, well, crap, these are, you know, this is the same game. I figured it out now. I know what they do at the university, and it's battle dice. So that's kind of the impetus behind Neo Victorian Skirmish Squad.
That's pretty cool. And I guess one thing I forgot to mention, which is pretty important, especially if folks want to, you know, download the machines, platforms, what kind of platforms will it support?
Well, we've built this game using Unity, which means that we can target practically anything. We've got the game up and running on PC, Mac, iOS, Android, Windows Phone. We've got it running on the Ouya, and we've also pledged our support. We're going to be doing a Linux build. We're hoping to target BlackBerry 10. That's one of the things that the Kickstarter is going to help us do, as well as PlayStation Network. So we're trying to get this out on as many platforms as we can. And if you look at our previous games, we've targeted most of those. So Ouya is new for us. PlayStation Network is new. BlackBerry and Linux. So those are the four that we're going to try to add to our stable of releases this time around. And I'm pretty confident we'll be able to do that.
So let's see. So folks interested in backing the game can pitch in $15, and that's the minimum level to, you know, start playing the game?
Yep, that's correct.
And $20 for beta access, and then everything up to, let's see, what was it? 2,500, so you can be a playable character and get an executive producer title.
Yep, yeah, that's our most premium tier, and all the goodies that come along with it. And we tried to offer some things we thought people would really like. We're doing a lot of kind of like handmade DIY things, right? So one of the monsters in our game are these things called dust gnomes, which are absolutely adorable and terrifying at the same time. And we found a really cool way to kind of like manufacture those within the studio. So, you know, you can have like a handmade dust gnome sitting on your desk, weighing down your papers and terrifying all of your office mates.
Can I ask what makes them so terrifying?
Okay, so when they open their mouths, they look like one of those angler fish from like a Jacques Cousteau video. It's just nothing but rows and rows of needle-like teeth. So yeah, on the exterior, they're very cute looking, but don't get your fingers anywhere near their mouth.
Just like Terry. I'm sorry, Terry. I couldn't resist.
That's true. It's not my fault you lost that hand, Alexis.
Oh, that's true. Yeah. So everybody on the podcast listening, you know, warning, Terry's a great guy, but just don't get too close. Keep your distance. So you mentioned you started developing games 10 years ago. You know, what got you started? Like, what was, you know, what caught your inspiration? Like, you know, man, I want to develop games for a living.
I know the exact moment when that happened. I was about 5 years old, and I was at a family friend's house, and they had a home version of the Pong console hooked up to a black and white TV. And I remember just like laying on the floor in their den playing this for hours on end and having fun with the game. But not just that, realizing that somebody built that was somebody's job to make this piece of entertainment. That kind of bridged the gap between human being and machine. And I fell in love with that idea. And from the time I was a little kid, I always wanted to be that guy. So for me, game development has been kind of a lifelong pursuit. And it wasn't really until about, I want to say 2004, when I decided to really make a go of it. And that's when I, you know, started committing to finishing projects. I've got a back catalog of unfinished games a mile long, you know, but yeah. Starting projects is fun, but finishing them is very difficult.
Yep.
So, you know, since then I've had some good critical success. The game that I'm probably most well known for is called Vanessa St. Pierre Delacroix and Her Nightmare. It's a title that just rolls right off the tongue for most people. But that game did well. We ended up winning a couple of awards and being invited to different indie game showcases.
PAX,
and we were right alongside titles like Limbo and Fez and Antichamber. So some pretty well-known indie games, we were kind of rubbing shoulders with them.
So you got to hang out with Phil Fish.
Yeah, that's right. In fact, if you watch Indie Game the movie, some of the footage there was shot at PAX Prime. And if they were just to pan the camera about 5 degrees to the left, I'm standing there waving because we were literally right next to them at PAX Prime.
Yeah, it's you by 5 degrees, you missed free promotion.
Right.
It's a good movie,
oh,
too.
Oh, well.
But no matter. You're on the Geek Improvement Podcast. It'll make up for the thousands of views for that Indie Game the movie has. So did you study game development or programming in general? Or
Never really formally. I'm a self-taught programmer, and I started back in the I want to say early 90s with a product called Hyper Studio for the Mac Classic.
Oh.
I learned Visual Basic from there, and then C++ and C#, and a bevy of other languages. And along the way also, I realized that if I wanted to make games, I'd need to know things like Photoshop and 3D Studio Max and audio editing software. So I'm kind of a jack of all trades, but design is really my specific wheelhouse. I love the act of creation and coming up with really interesting mechanics and creating fun play spaces for people. And then programming for me is just kind of a means to an end, really. But yeah. My formal education, I have a master's degree from the University of Central Florida in modeling and simulation with a focus on usability. And that's kind of what got me my full-time job at DeVry, and how I met David on this podcast. He's one of my students whose grade is currently on the line, depending on how well tonight goes.
It might be the first time my grade's been on the line. Get used to the stress.
But FERPA laws prevent me from discussing specifics.
But, I'm glad to hear that, you're a self-taught developer, and that it wasn't necessarily programming for the sake of, learning how to program. It was, you had these ideas, and you wanted to get them out there. And so, it was the means to the end. So that's, why you learned to program.
Right.
So I come from a similar background from Python and whatnot. Nothing.
Okay.
No game development, but.
Well, that's not cool. Yet, anyways.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. So let's see. What else should we cover? Oh yes, if you want to back Neo Victorian Skirmish Squad, which we highly recommend that you do, you can visit geekimprovement.com/skirmish, and it'll route you directly to the Kickstarter page. You've got, 6 days left. Your goal is $7,500, and you're nearly at $3,600. So, come on, guys. We really, 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 really want to play.
Yeah, we feel pretty confident. The way the Kickstarter works is you get a lot of friends and family, commit right up front, and that's your first big influx of backers. And then the middle portion just sucks because you're kind of fighting for every individual backer, for a good 10 solid days. And then towards the end, what happens is the Kickstarter engine really revs up. And so in the last handful of days, you get a bunch of people who are discovering your project because it's finally made it onto the front page. We're waiting for that to kick in. And we've got a couple of aces in the hole, I guess, that we're looking to roll out here over the next week.
Oh, nice.
Some shady backroom deals that we're trying to secure for that.
Actually,
premium tiers.
On that note, I was going to ask you, I like the way your game definitely is interesting and everything, but I do have to ask, in your video, you say you had to sell a kidney to fund that. I was going to ask if you have two, you don't need the other one, because I could definitely use a kidney. Don't ask questions.
So I was actually born with three, so it's funny you ask. I can sell plenty of kidneys.
Podcast co-host discount, right?
Right.
Excellent. So yeah, we really, really want to see you guys blow this Kickstarter out of the water, and we can't wait to play. So now, that we've got Sushil here, before we move on to the rest of the podcast, I'll save it for later. Yeah, that's what they call a tease in radio. Let's just hop into the other topics, and let's see what Sushil has to say, and David and Terry, we'll get a nice mix of perspectives here.
Fantasy Geek.
So at PH Mullins on Twitter, Patrick, to those of us who tweet at him constantly, he sent a few things our way. One of them was learntabletoprpgs.com. So geek improvement being, improve yourself as a geek. There's so much geeky things to do out there that, well, you know, sometimes movies and stuff slip under radar, or hey, you may have not played a tabletop RPG. So if you want to, this site has a pretty good guide to getting started, and it also has a couple of lists of fantasy RPGs and horror and science fiction ones, and even has some free starter games that you can pick up. So, David, I hear that you, or Sushil, I should say, here you have a confession of sorts to divulge.
Yeah, you know, despite teaching game and simulation programming and having made award-winning video games in my past, I have never actually played a tabletop role-playing game.
Oh, that's a kick to the geek cred right there, Professor.
I know. I'm tearing up my geek card right now, just turning it in.
You got to hand it over. We're sorry. It's the rules, Professor. It's the rules.
It's no good. It's no good. I get teased at the studio quite a lot. You know, they love Dungeons and Dragons and all these other games. And yeah, I've never played them before, and I've actually never had the opportunity to do so. And I think that's going to change here shortly. I love this website, by the way. Learn Tabletop RPGs. It's fantastic, and it's gotten kind of fired up to check some of them out.
Yeah, and, you know, I've got to say that David, Terry, and I hadn't really played D&D until, what, maybe 2 years ago, 2.5 years?
Something like this we definitely could have used, considering while when we did start playing Dungeons & Dragons, it was certainly fun, and I know we enjoyed ourselves, we didn't really...
Rules? What rules?
Exactly. Between that and David liking
campaigns?
First NPC we met. There's the first NPC we met. She's trying to possess. She's trying to progress the story. David says she's an elf. Kill the elf. And there we go.
You know, I have a complete. You know, it's completely and utterly reasonable to kill all the elves you come across. It's just, how can you let these vile creatures live? My commandments and my God tell me they must die.
And so that pretty much happened for the whole of the game.
That and a mixture of, can I seduce him?
Yep.
And also, can I bluff him?
Oh, yes, that was fun too.
I was DMing for a while, and Terry, there was a particular quest where there were a whole bunch of dark elves, and we were going into this cavern.
It was not dark elves. It was
dark dwarves.
Dark dwarves, but they had a specific name. I think it's Dwegger or something like Druger, something like that. Yeah. Go on, Alexis.
And so Terry wanted to know if he could, you know, fake them out. He was playing a dwarf himself, so he could grab some ash from one of
I rubbed some dirt on my face, right? And I took David and Jordan's characters, and I said that they were slaves. So with the ash and the dirt all over my face, I was now a dark dwarf.
It was beautiful, and he kept, I told him, okay, if you really want to do that, you can, just, you know, you got to pass all the checks, and he was passing them, like, they were.
We got into about four rooms, and every room, Alexis would have it, so, every room we got into, Alexis would have it, so, every enemy in that room would start following us. And so David, especially the character that David was playing, started to get antsy. I myself started to get antsy. Everyone started to get antsy. And eventually this ended with four or five rooms in. Finally, one of us, I don't remember if it was myself or David or Jordan, the other guy who was playing with us.
I do believe it was me who ended up...
I'm relatively sure it's you, because that's my general policy. When in doubt, blame David. But... after four or five rooms in, all these enemies on us, David finally gets antsy, decides he's going to attack one of them, and every enemy from the last four or five or however many rooms I've bluffed us through with my glorious dirt disguise suddenly attacks us all at once.
And the best thing is that if they had continued their bluff, I would have let them go through the entire quest without fighting a single thing if they met all the checks.
Now, again, if we met all the checks. We couldn't afford to get to that last room.
David, I was on a liar.
And then have us wiped out by 20 dark dwarves and their leader.
Terry has a slight gambling problem.
Slight gambling problem. I was on fire. And you never quit when you're ahead. And if you lose, you got to keep going to make it up. So, now, that also, though, that does prove that I'm not entirely sure if any of that would have been to the rules, but it was certainly fun.
Oh, you know, absolutely. What I'm saying? And I think that's the beauty of, you know, tabletop games, that you can, you know...
Fudge the rules a little bit?
Exactly. It's something that, you know, video games just don't always allow. But kind of like Munchkin. You make up a rule is valid if the owner of the game says it is. Are you a Munchkin fan, Sushil?
Oh, I love Munchkin. Yeah, that's a great game.
Yeah, we recently started playing, and
we play it every time we're over at Alexis's.
First thing we do. Gratuitous amounts of laughter and plotting to kill my two best friends.
And mutilating the bodies.
Oh, yes, of course. And so now that we're on D&D, you might as well mention that the original D&D is getting a new deluxe edition. So 1974, the box set of D&D that came out was in a white box. But now they're re-releasing it, now that it's almost 40 years old, in a wooden box. And with white manuals and everything, and it is very nice. But it's also very expensive at $149.
Yeah, it is quite expensive. That's one thing that I've always been a little antsy about when it comes to tabletop gaming. That's a pretty expensive hobby right there.
Yeah, and quests themselves can also get pretty expensive.
Now, is this exactly as the original white box was, or does it come with anything unique or special? Or
it's certainly embellished. The original white box was just cardboard with like a printed wood grain pattern on the outside. But this is actual wood, and it comes with like three volumes and like four supplements. So it's if you're a D&D collector, it's a very nice thing to get a hold of. Of course, it's coming out November 19th, so you still have a while to save up those pennies.
And as the the old president of Sony would tell you, you would be glad to pick up a second job to afford this.
Yes, that's true.
Stab at old wounds, David, and reaching low.
And next thing that actually, the second thing that Patrick sent our way is Dungeons and Developers, which might please Sushil a bit. You know, we've got talent trees and whatnot in pen and paper RPGs, and particularly online games now, where they're more interactive talent trees. This one is for web developers specifically. So you can plug in your name, you can say, okay, level one, HTML, the main language for creating web page, yada, 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 yada. Next rank, you understand how to create and view a basic web page. And so, like, you can rank up in different stuff like SEO, server administration, JavaScript, and eventually, you know, reach server-side development mastery and stuff. So actually,
that's pretty cool. I like that.
That makes me wonder. You mostly focus on video game development, Sushil, right?
That's correct.
Have you ever dabbled in HTML and web stuff?
Yeah, a little bit. We teach, or in some of my classes, I've introduced HTML5 and JavaScript, just as kind of like a little added bonus for some of our students, because we recognize that it's a growing trend in game development. I spent probably a good 2 weeks. Of my life playing Cookie Clicker here recently, and I'm very angry at myself for doing that. So yeah, like all these web games, they're very sticky. You know what I mean? They can catch you.
And especially since you don't have to whip out a dedicated games console or something.
Exactly. No matter where you are, you know, if you have a cell phone in your pocket, a smartphone, you can hop online and play for the most part. So
Cookie Clicker. Yes, I've seen this.
No, it's horrible. Don't even start.
Yeah, everyone in class was talking about the last couple.
I'm going to regret asking this. What's Cookie Clicker?
Oh God. So you start the game with one cookie, and you just click on it, and it gives you more cookies, and then you can spend those cookies to buy cursors that click on the cookie for you, and then eventually you can buy grandmas that bake cookies on your behalf, and it just that you always chase the dragon, but you never catch it. It's one of those kinds of games, you know. And then 2 days later, you realize that you've wasted your life. That's Cookie Clicker.
Alexis, I'm going to be busy next week.
Can't do the podcast.
What is it, another Garashadon, Terry?
Cookie Clicker, Adon.
So yeah, Dungeons and Developers. If you're a web developer, fill out the tree there, and they'll give you a link up top. The way they do this is pretty interesting. They don't make you create an account. What it does is that it creates a unique URL with your name, and then for every talent that you add, it changes the URL ever so slightly to register that you have that talent. So it's actually a pretty neat way to do something that doesn't require an account. So pretty slick, I think. So, moving on, I would play this.
Comic Geek!
I almost thought we didn't have that bumper. Masters of Anatomy. This is...
I thought that was David's title.
Geek Improvement Master Anatomy, David Janovich.
Only in private, Terry. It's only between me and you and your mom.
Yep, there it goes. David cannot resist the your mom jokes. So,
at least when it's aimed towards Terry.
Sushil, now you know his weakness.
Man, I'm learning too much about David today.
We'll never be able to look each other in the eyes in class, no. Professor.
Yeah, as far as I'm concerned, this podcast never happened.
But Masters of Anatomy, I spotted them on Facebook, actually. They were trying to bombard me with an advertisement. I thought, what in the world is this thing? And
Whoa, wait. You got an advertisement of this guy, like, what I'm assuming is what I'm looking at now, this guy's ass, and you're like, I think I'll click on this.
No, they mentioned something about
it. You won't click on the things I send you, but random things.
They mentioned something about a Kickstarter. I thought, this is interesting, and it was geared about comic stuff. And it turns out this is essentially recreating the anatomy guides for illustrators that have been coming out for decades and decades. But this time, instead of making them, you know, traditional anatomy guides, they're taking different kinds of styles. So whether it be monster pigs or orcs or sentient alligators, and different kinds of styles of illustration and different kinds of characters and things and subjects. And they're compiling these different views so that if you want to vary your kinds of style or learn how to make these different kinds of illustrations, you can. Kickstarter isn't out yet, though. It's they're drumming up anticipation. I think it's October 11th, Friday. So if you're interested in learning how to draw or studying the different kinds of styles, a Masters of Anatomy is your thing. But I can only draw stick figures, and I'm not proud of that. But actually, that's another thing, David. As a game developer, do you do much art for your own games?
Oh no, I tend to farm out the artwork to other people. My level of talent at Photoshop and 3D Studio Max is fairly limited, and I'd rather somebody that has an area of expertise actually use it. But looking through the artwork that's on the website for this book, Masters of Anatomy, this is fantastic. It's something that we definitely would want to have on our shelves at the studio, just as a reference guide, if nothing else. I mean, every game should have a unique look, something that matches the style of the gameplay and the tone of the story, if it has one. And I think that this would be great for artists to kind of flip through and get some inspiration, because it's a very like wide variety of styles, and many of them would lend themselves very well to game development.
Yeah. So if it's not for a person who, you know, would use this for their work, like game development or illustration, it would probably make a good coffee book or coffee table book. So it looks pretty neat. But unfortunately, that's all we have for the comic section this week. But we are a bit front-loaded, well, I guess back-loaded in this case, since it's towards the end of the program on the video game things.
Video Game Geek!
I couldn't have asked for a better week to have you on, Sushil.
Oh, man. Yeah, this is all really good news. I'm happy about this stuff.
It's a good thing I caught him in class when I did, then.
Oh, yeah. Well, let's see. Valve, finally, after months and months of mostly rumors and not really any leaks from Valve. Valve is a pretty tight ship. Lots of Steam news this week. So SteamOS was the first thing out. It is an operating system made by Valve based on Linux that will... It's going to be free, so you'll be able to load it on whatever machine you want. And it's built to work for your living room. So you can make a living room PC, hook it up to your TV, and you can stream games from, say, your PC or Mac to the living room box. It'll put it up on the TV, and you can use your keyboard and mouse. And you can even play Linux games right on the hardware itself. And they've also said that you can watch movies and TVs, or not TVs, movies and like TV shows. But they haven't announced any partners like Netflix or whatever, but you can guess that that's exactly who they're working for or working with. So, as a game developer and also as an enthusiast, you know, what do you think of SteamOS?
I think this is really cool. You know, Steam has been a phenomenal platform on the PC, and I think among most of the gamers that I know, it's really their go-to outlet for games on the PC. You know, and I like the idea that a company like Valve would try to expand and kind of carve a niche into the world of consoles, you know. So this is a good first step for them, and I'm really excited to see if PC gamers will mind moving to the couch one room over. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So you know, can we get out of the PC and can we sit on the couch now and play these same games and not feel like we're playing a console? And I think that's really what Steam will have to capture here is the PC experience, but from the comfort of the couch, right?
Yeah.
And the big thing I can see though is the reason you play on a computer is mostly because, you know, keyboard and mouse. Keyboard and mouse is, you know, usually played good on a flat surface, but you can't really guarantee a comfortable flat surface in your living room.
However,
which kind of seems at odds with trying to make a PC feel for your living room.
Well, two things. You can either use one of those like TV dinner trays.
I tried that, Alexis. It's not quite as awesome as it sounds. You need like two of them, and then you need another one for your drinks and food, and then you're running out of TV trays.
You box yourself in, and then when you got to go to the bathroom, it just becomes a pain. So then you get the catheter, and just
then the cat wants to play with your catheter, and
yeah,
nope, that's it.
I thought we'd never speak of that again, David.
Not a good thing, but Valve has announced something that'll be able to pair with these SteamOS devices, which we should talk about in a second here, is its Steam controller. So it is its own custom controller, and it is pretty weird looking. It doesn't have dual thumbsticks. It has dual trackpads instead. So it's supposedly very, very sensitive, and it approaches, supposedly, the accuracy of keyboard and mouse and that kind of sensitivity. So anybody here, lamenting the loss of thumbsticks?
I like my thumbsticks, thank you very much.
I'm inclined to agree, but
There's something about the resistance of a thumbstick that kind of makes at least controller gaming.
Yeah.
I kind of like having that little bit of resistance as it kind of says, David, you're aiming at something, or David, you're moving at something. It's kind of hard to get the same feel on the keyboard, unfortunately, because the, you know, arrow keys and WASD and the mouse don't quite get the same sort of feedback.
Right. So it's kind of the same sort of problem that you have when you're using a keyboard on a tablet, right? I mean, you don't get the force feedback, the feel of the click of the keys under your fingers. So this is something that I think I'm going to reserve judgment on it until I can actually get my hands on it and play around with it. Because I think, like, from a game development perspective, I'm looking at that device and I'm saying to myself, I can't develop on this controller the same way that I would develop on a controller with thumbsticks. I'm going to have to treat it differently. And I think that's something that, you know, it may be kind of like what we saw with the Nintendo Wii, that some developers used the remote really well and some really didn't, you know, or the motion controls. And I think it might come down to how well the game development community can develop specifically for this controller. And again, I don't think you can treat it like a standard controller with thumbsticks. It's got to be its own sort of animal.
And on that note,
you couldn't develop it like a keyboard and mouse either. That thing's just it might just run into that, like you said, the Wiimote syndrome, where it's just a little too awkward to actually program for.
Yeah.
And on that note, it doesn't have a D-pad, so that in itself, I mean, not that many games use D-pads now, especially on PC and whatnot, but I guess that's essentially WASD. It, you know, doesn't. It lacks the hardware capability to do that.
Well, I know a lot of like fighting gamers are not going to be happy about that, right? If there's no D-pad, that kind of cuts them off at the knee, I guess, in terms of executing moves properly.
Then again, most hardcore fighting gamers have their like $150 arcade cabinet box
stick,
with all the buttons
sticking buttons.
Yeah, but those are usually the most hardcore. One thing that is really interests me about this thing is that it has a couple of, I think it's four maybe, of haptic feedback sensors, so essentially rumble, but they can also be used for sound. They're essentially speakers.
That's the first thing I looked at. That looked like an old boombox. I kind of expect the trackpads to start bouncing out a little bit and sound waves to come out of them.
Yeah. I don't think the trackpads themselves are actually, well, they may have the haptic feedback. I'm not sure, but on the back, certainly, they've got two there that I think I see. But that the rumble areas can be used as speakers just kind of blows my mind. I mean, it makes sense from like the bone conductive speakers things and whatnot, but
yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think this is something really that gamers should be excited about. We need to have innovation in hardware in order to make games better in time. And if we get locked into the idea that a gamepad has to be a certain way, yep. then games will only be a certain way. So I think that, you know, Valve has a lot of goodwill within the gaming community. And I think that this is the sort of thing that some of the, I guess the way that it looks maybe is a little odd, yeah. But again, I'm just going to be reserving judgment until I can get my hands on it and play around with it. And you know, hopefully this is something that, maybe some of the other companies might follow suit and change up some of their hardware next time around. You never know. I mean, innovation is what drives this industry, and I'm happy to see that.
I don't know, Sushil. Val's goodwill might be running a little short. I haven't seen anything about Half-Life 3.
I was just going to say, Half-Life 3 confirmed, baby. I haven't seen anything, therefore it's confirmed.
If you were following this story, they said that they had three announcements that they were going to be making, right? And I'm like, oh, this is it. You know, third announcement.
No, they're totally playing. They're playing straight into that. They know it. They're the best trolls in the industry currently.
Well, rumors... The latest rumors are that Half-Life 3 has actually been canceled. It's been scrapped. So
they're gonna rename it instead. They can't go to 3, so they gotta go back. You know, now it's gonna be Quarter-Life 1.
You know, or they could just remake Half-Life 2 Episode 2 or something. I would, if I were Valve, I'd do that just to piss people off.
Half-Life 2 Episode 2.1.
Now in the new Source engine. But again, going back to this, these speaker things for a moment, I hope they have better audio quality than the Wiimote. That's sound like a Hallmark card, but Mortal Pixel in the chat room says that you can execute combos with analog, using an analog stick. So there is that for fighting gamers.
Yeah, you can. It's just I've tried it before. It's just nowhere near as awesome and coordinated as the D-pad is.
Yeah.
At least for most standard fighting games, there are some. Most of them that don't really require exact movements with the stick that, you know, will allow you to do your moves or use button combinations instead of stick and button combinations. Those work really well with a stick itself.
Yeah. So the most arguably, maybe right, bundled with the SteamOS, the most important announcement that came from Valve are Steam Machines. So the hardware that will be running this OS... not necessarily, again, you don't have to buy this hardware because they're going to give away the OS for free, but you have this option, and it's coming not only from Valve, but from other PC makers. So it's Valve hasn't quite said what the specs are going to be on this thing or price, but it's set to reveal that soon.
Soon? What type of soon are we talking about? You know, Blizzard soon, regular soon?
Excite. soon, actually, I think. Or at least we'll start to see Steam Machines on Monday. A company called XI3, it's a custom PC manufacturer. They make these little teeny tiny PCs. Maybe they're about, if you were to think, maybe as wide as a liter of Mountain Dew, you know, the ultimate measurement unit for geeks. Not so much as high, maybe about... 8 inches tall or so, or 6 inches tall. It's a tiny, tiny box, and the motherboard is actually split into like three pieces, and like it is a U in size, so they can like slot things into like this tiny space. And they're poised to announce something on Monday, one of their new Steam Machines. So we'll finally see how much it is. This one's going to be, at least the one that they've shown us before, is hovering around $1,000. That's pretty expensive. You're, you know, paying for the luxury of having such a tiny thing. But I don't know. Sushil, what do you expect these things to go for?
I don't know. I'm pretty sure that they're going to have to be priced competitively because we've got the Xbox One and PlayStation 4 coming out. And if we want gamers to really buy into this, I think that it's got to undercut that significantly.
So... I was just about to say a quick thing. Someone accidentally opened the show in a tab, and we're listening to the live stream. some feedback there, but
yeah, it wasn't for me. I got mine.
My bad. Sorry about that.
Don't sweat it. Again, your disappearance and this flub will all disappear in post.
Supposedly, that goes into the after show.
It could be. It could be for the blooper reel. Yeah, I think they're gonna have to walk a fine line here, but they don't have to go as cheap as the Ouya, which is $100 or so. They could go for
But once the novelty wears off, they gotta batten down the hatches and start aiming out there.
Well, what I love about this is that they're making it kind of like a quote unquote open hardware initiative where all sorts of manufacturers can say, hey, yeah, this is our machine, but then again, everything is going to be relabeled as a Steam machine. If some PC manufacturer out there has a gaming machine, you can be damn sure that they're going to just load up Steam OS and now it's a Steam box. Same hardware, same everything, just, rebadge, rebrand.
My computer can run Steam OS. Yes. You know, I have a Steam machine. And I didn't have to pay anything for it. Bam. Okay.
Is the Steam machine, the name, it makes sense, and it's not bad or anything. But I can't shake this feeling that it reminds me of was it like the 90s like Matchbox cars kind of things? Was it Steam Mean Machines or something like that? I can't.
Not sure what you're talking about, Alexis.
You're talking old school, Alexis.
Yeah, like some little like cars. I'll remember sometime. But man, I just can't stop thinking about like those Matchbox cars. So good news all around on the Steam front. We're pretty happy to see what Valve has done here. And if I had a science kind of theme, I'd play it right now with Scott Johnson's dulcet tones, announcing that it's now the science section, not just the science.
You want me to give me to give it a shot, Alexis?
Oh,
science geek.
Science. Okay, so. NASA's Curiosity.
Or was that David or Alexis? Because both of you have ear butter voices when you want to.
that was all David. Let's see. So, Curiosity has NASA's Mars rover has been roaming around Mars for over a year now, probably about a year and a month, and its results from its tests are coming back now. NASA's releasing academic papers that have come out, and one of them talks about water in Martian soil. So yes, there is water on Mars. It's not a big old lake. Companies can't start, try to duplicate the French Riviera up there or anything. But it's actually, in the dirt. So what Curiosity did was it scooped some dirt up, put it in its belly, heated it up, and the steam that came... Once again, steam makes a return. It found steam in there. It's like, whoa, there's water in here. So if you were to take... I can't remember how much dirt, but you could essentially take a couple of scoops of dirt, heat it up, and you'll have like a couple bottles of water. So that's pretty neat.
So we're one step closer to actually having moisture farms.
Yeah,
and one step closer to the return of the Reapers, David. That's what I was going to say. It's only a matter of time. This is how it starts. That's all I'm saying.
Well, I'll put it right now. If NASA wants to send me to Mars and start a moisture farm, I will gladly do it.
So, Sushil, does this give you any ideas for maybe a sci-fi game?
No. I think it's really cool, though. I mean, this is amazing, and the idea that we could actually send people up to Mars, and I mean, they could, with the extreme radiation notwithstanding, and the lack of atmosphere notwithstanding, they can actually drink water. Yeah. So we can send people to Mars and drink water. I think that's awesome. Maybe that's the game, right? Martian water drinker.
It'll be a flash game.
Kind of like Don't Starve or Minecraft, except you got to keep your water gauge up and you got to keep burning dirt.
Don't dehydrate.
The most thrilling game ever. And something, from a bit more of an academic tilt, also great timing since, we've got a professor here, is that these papers NASA released are all behind a paywall. So... you have to pony up to get them. And Congress, there's a guy named Michael Eisen who collected all the papers and has them up for free on his website. He says he's doing the U.S. government a favor because it's helping it comply U.S. copyright laws. He says, the whole situation is even more absurd because U.S. copyright law explicitly says that all works of the federal government, of which these surely must be included, are not subject to copyright. So, in the interest of helping NASA and Science Magazine comply with U.S. law, I'm making copies of these papers freely available here. So, if you really want to read them, they're up there. We'll link them in the show notes, but...
Just, you know, don't tell Jeff. He doesn't need to know.
Again, for those not in the know, Jeff is our personal NSA liaison. Or
he's watching us right now.
Yeah, he never says a word, but we know he's there.
Time for the pants to come off, right?
And it may fall into a gray area because, you know, Science Magazine is a private company and it has a hand creating these papers. But do you think this guy, Michael Eisen, is doing a good thing by pushing these papers out there for free? Or is he...
From a legal standpoint, I don't know how much trouble he could get in, really, but I mean, his argument is sound. Like, if the government produces something, we technically own that. And especially when it comes to knowledge, that's easy to distribute. So, you know, maybe NASA could kind of split the difference and maybe publish a separate version of these papers on their own website. Maybe that, you know, doesn't step on the toes of Science Magazine, but... for the most part, I think this is an issue that most people are going to kind of overlook. They're going to get the headlines on, on CNN or Huffington Post or whatever, and they'll be happy learning from there. And, you know, most people aren't going to want to delve into the Science magazine anyways. So I hope he stays out of trouble. And I think it's, you know, cool that he's taking the risk to put that information out there.
Yeah, so I think I agree. He's in a kind of gray area, but... You know, kudos to him for taking a stand. So, before we let you go, because we're all fresh out of show notes, rounding up...
Well, not necessarily, Alexis. You still got that Semitic UI thing you got over here.
I think he was setting that up in a classy way, David. Thanks for spoiling it.
No, David reminded me.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Then I withdraw my your God is wrong, David.
David, do good.
Yeah, David, do fantastic. So we've seen, going into the computer geek kind of thing, which I don't think we have a bumper for either, and it doesn't matter because the soundboard...
Computer geek!
Thank you, David. Now I can sample that and play it whenever we want. Have you guys heard of Bootstrap?
You mentioned it, but I forgot.
I want to say it's familiar, but I don't think I've ever actually done anything with it.
Social Bootstrap not ringing a bell?
Nope.
Okay, so yeah, this is more in the kind of like web development kind of range. So Twitter, about a couple years ago now, put out something called Bootstrap. It is a CSS and HTML kind of a framework. They've got some essentially pre-baked things where you can start developing a website on their grid. So you don't have to worry about like spacing things, like fonts, ordered lists have their own style, and all sorts of stuff. So Twitter is, Bootstrap is one of the foremost kind of HTML and CSS frameworks.
Oh, okay. I think I know this. You showed this to me a while back when we were talking, you know, personal stuff, right?
Yeah. And so it's pretty neat. Bootstrap, however, it just underwent a major redesign. It's now on version 3. It's has a more flat design because, you know, flat is the future, at least for now.
Well, and so is, you know, gray and brown. It's also the future.
for console gaming, yeah, or at least this past generation. And there's another competing framework called Zurb. Or no, Foundation. Wait. Yeah, Foundation by the company called Zurb. And now there's a new player that I stumble across. It's not very new, I don't think. It's at 0.2.2, so it still hasn't reached 1.0. They don't even recommend it for production yet, but it is pretty nice when you're programming something. Well, not program, but coding something in with Bootstrap, like to have a column or whatever. Like the classes that you have to write are col-lg-4 and this kinds of things. But here it focuses on, you know, like language semantics, not necessarily from like a programming perspective. So it says class column. None of this kind of hieroglyphic kind of stuff that is indecipherable. And they have a good look, too. It's a flat look. It's open source. I believe it's used the MIT license. So those web developers out there looking for a new framework to dive into, this is one we're going to use internally, actually, in a project you'll hopefully hear word of soon. And soon, TM, copyrighted by Valve. And yeah, just it's a neat thing for web developers.
Yeah, that's really cool. I'm looking at the website now, and I will say that natural language in any kind of programming or scripting or data management is kind of like the way of the future. So the way I see it, everybody's going to be a programmer in the next like 20 years, right? I mean, it's getting to that point where programming languages and data storage, things like XML and HTML, these different languages are being touched on even by very casual computer users. And the more we see stuff like semantic, the easier that becomes, and the more it proliferates through our society. And eventually, I think everybody's going to be programming and scripting and doing markup. So this is cool. It's a step in the right direction.
Instead of having to learn this different language in high school, you have to be literate in computer languages now.
Right,
that's
exactly.
That's kind of something I kind of wish they had back when I was in high school.
Back in my day.
You know what's crazy? I was at a store today called Paladin Tech and Games out in Avalon, and I met a kid there. I was showing off the Neo Victorian Skirmish Squad. I met a kid there who I think you said he was in fifth grade, and he's learning Ruby. Like, are you serious? Like, he's taking a class at his middle school, and they're teaching him Ruby. I'm like, that is just crazy. Wow, we didn't have anything like that when I was a kid.
Nice.
So I have to ask. You mentioned Avalon is a what store were you at?
Oh, Paladin Tech and Games.
Paladin Tech and Games.
It's out in Avalon, the community. It's beyond UCF if you're in East Orlando. Take Colonial State Road 50, out past UCF, and you get on Avalon Park Road. And it's out there. And yeah, that store's been open for about 5 years, and the owner is a professor at Full Sail, actually.
Oh, very cool. Yeah, Coliseum Comics is our usual haunt here in Kissimmee, but I never heard of Paladin Tech and Games.
Yeah, it was actually my first time being out there, but pretty cool little store.
So yeah, actually, that's something we should ask guests from now on. What's your go-to local game store?
Oh man, do I have to pick one? I don't know.
You can pick as many as you want.
I spend quite a bit of time at a comic shop at Sci-Fi City. Okay. Those are probably the two biggest ones. I do like if you've ever been to the Hobby Spot, which moved now. It's across the street from Sci-Fi City on Colonial. That place is really cool. They used to be on Fairbanks, and the store that they were in was so small you couldn't hardly get a scope of their inventory. And now that they're in a bigger location, oh man, if you're a geek, if you're a nerd, you know, whether it's comic books or trains or video games, definitely check out the Hobby Spot, man. They're awesome.
Hey Alexis.
Yeah.
I smell road trip.
I was just going to say that, David. The second he started talking about the Paladin store, I could hear it in his voice.
So last time I was at the Hobby Spot, they had you remember the Virtual Boy, right? The Nintendo Virtual Boy?
Okay. One of the greatest failures in the history of
Yes. They had the entire collection. You can buy not only the system itself, but every game that was ever produced for it. Wow. So they have it on sale there.
You know, I think this is starting to have the makings of a recurring feature. Maybe we can have like a Proustian Q&A of our guests to kind of like get a feel for them. So, speaking of the Virtual Boy, what is the one thing in your collection, whether it be video games or comics or whatever, you know, that you're probably either most fond of or most proud of?
Oh man, that's really tough. I would say that probably my proudest thing hasn't arrived yet, but I backed the Shadowgate Kickstarter earlier this year. And if you're unfamiliar with it, Shadowgate was a point and click adventure game. It was one of the original point and click graphical adventure games, as a matter of fact, done by Infocom, back in the 80s. Mm-hmm. And that was like one of my absolute favorite games as a kid. And it's one of the very few titles that I can specifically point to and say, this is why I make video games. So they're redoing it. They're doing like a modern version of it. And they raised money on Kickstarter to do this. And I went full geek and I pledged more money than I should have. But I'm getting some like really cool items, you know, memorabilia from Shadowgate. And in the course of doing this, I was talking with David Marsh, who was one of the creators of the game. And, I introduced myself, told him who I was. And I mentioned like, yeah, you know, I made this game called Vanessa St. Pierre Delacroix and Her Nightmare. And he's like, oh, no kidding. I have that on my iPhone. I'm like, dude, full circle. You know, like, this is amazing.
the thing that got you into things.
Yeah, exactly. And he's actually played my game, and I'm like, well, that is amazing. So that's one of my, I guess, favorite moments. And when all those Kickstarter goodies finally arrive, I think those will be some of my favorite treasures.
Very cool. Now, cons here in Florida, we usually, at least in Central Florida, we've got, you know, MegaCon. Do you visit any cons kind of regularly, whether it be in-state or out-of-state?
Not regularly. I've been to PAX Prime. I've been to PAX East. I go to them when I can. It's just a matter of having the travel budget, right. You know. But okay. if you don't mind me pimping out some
Pimp
of my
away,
own work,
man.
Here in Orlando, we do a monthly showcase of independent games called Indienomicon.
Oh.
And I'm one of a group of people. We promote, run, and organize these events. So they're once a month, first Thursday of every month. We showcase two locally developed independent video games. And we've had, you know, crowds, 70 to 80 people generally show up. And our next one, I don't know when this is going to air, but October 3rd at 7:30 p.m. at a comic shop, we're going to be showing off two locally developed indie games, Waking Amy, which is a really cool adventure-style game done in 3D, and Rise to Perdition, which is a full-sale student game. So, yeah, if anybody's hearing this and they want to check out some local indie games here in Orlando, Indienomicon.
Very nice. I'm going to edit this tonight or tomorrow morning, and so people will be able to have a chance to listen to it before October 3rd, yeah?
Ooh. You know, Alexis,
uh-huh.
I think we might be able to get into some of these things. What do you think about some on-site reporting for some GI works?
This would be cool. I could whip out Google Glass and review people. And...
Dude, we would absolutely love that. So we can talk offline and get that set up, but I think
sure.
That's something that we would definitely appreciate having on hand.
Awesome, okay. One question. What time is it?
So I'm going to be there at 7 p.m.
Okay.
And the show officially starts at 7:30.
Beautiful. Okay. And it's not a Monday or Tuesday when I work my day job. So we're golden. We'll have a report on next week's podcast.
Cool.
And so one last question here. Microsoft, Nintendo, or Sony, where does your allegiance lie?
I would say that... for consoles, I spend more time on my Nintendo Wii than on the Xbox, and I don't own a PlayStation, so I'm two out of three there. But I am a hardcore Windows Phone enthusiast.
One of those.
So I don't know where that places me. I'm one of 12 people that own a Windows Phone.
No, Windows Phone is actually pretty nice. I've got nothing against it other than the app ecosystem is, you know, it needs more games from you, Sushil.
Oh, yeah. So we're trying our best.
All right. Is there anything else you'd like to mention that, you know, we didn't grill you on?
No, you know what? I just wanted to thank you guys for having me on here. This has been a lot of fun. I definitely appreciate the opportunity to talk about Neo-Victorian Skirmish Squad and our Kickstarter. And, let's do this again sometime. I'd be happy to be on here as a special guest and,
absolutely.
You know, talk about video games and indie stuff, whatever you want.
Beautiful, and we're happy to have you on and to help get the word out. So we'll be seeing more of you if we didn't scare you off.
anytime you need the geek out, Professor, we'll always be here every week, Friday or Saturday.
Sounds good, man.
So where can we find you? Can we find you on Twitter and keep up on, you know, what you're eating for lunch?
Oh, you know, I'm getting better about social networking. You can find me more on Facebook. Twitter's kind of intermittent.
Okay. So yeah, you just have to search for Mr. Sushil on Facebook if you're a hardcore fan. You can find me on Twitter at Alexis Santos, and you can find David and Terry at their emails, respectively, Terry at geekimprovement.com or David at geekimprovement.com. Thanks for being here, Sushil. David and Terry, as always, hopefully, and we'll see you next week.